It's February. It's the month of hearts.
Oh.
It's the heart month.
Okay, this I have a movie that Andy and I just watched. It was sweet. Ooh. It's kind of a love story, but I recommend it. It's about, I don't want to tell you the title yet, because it's about the inventor of it's about the inventor of Flaming Hot Cheetos. Have you seen this?
Okay.
And the title is Flamin' Hot.
It's just a joke.
So I just wanted to give reference before I said, ooh, me and Andy just watched.
Okay, fair enough. So it's Flamin' Hot.
That could go so many
ways. That's
what
I'm saying.
Yes. Yeah. No, you were
Flaming
smart.
Flaming Hot. Because I did. I sent it out to like my small group. Like, you guys have to watch this movie. And I'm like, and by the way, it's like about the guy who invented Flaming Hot Cheetos, because it was like crickets for like 2 hours. It was like, you guys, you need to watch it.
That is
it's
really
so
really
good.
Funny.
Have you seen it, Mikey? Because it's okay. It's PG. It's okay for teens, and there's no sexy scenes.
No, I haven't
it's
heard of it.
Very good. I cried.
Okay, this
I
is
laughed.
So interesting.
It was so good.
Okay, I'm gonna watch it. But we all know that Flamin' Hot Cheetos are so bad
it's,
for you.
So that's
right? Like
what brought
dye.
It. This is why I thought of it.
This is a
because
real problem.
I was like, literally. Crying in the movie, and it was so beautiful. And towards the end, it showed all his accolades, and I was like,
"You're like, you've ruined our bodies. We've been consuming
I literally said that. Yes. I was bawling, and I'm like, I'm so thankful for his own family and story, but he single-handedly has ruined America.
He's ruined dying.
America, and I like had such a moment of like, oh, I'm so happy
funny.
For you and your American story, but darn, dude, you also you've also caused a really bad disruption to our health. Okay, but great movie.
Oh, that is so funny. Okay. Good to know. And we're talking to a doctor today, so it kind of goes along with it about our hearts, and it's important what we put in our bodies. A friend of mine who's a physician, she will and works with kids and teenagers. Like when someone comes in, she will literally like check them out and look at their fingertips. She's not like, show me your fingertips, but she's looking and seeing if their fingers are dyed.
Yes.
Like they've been eating Flamin' Hot Cheetos or Takis or something, which there's alternative, like. The trader, we are obviously not sponsored by Takis or Flamin' Hot Cheetos or Trader Joe's, but Trader Joe's has their own like version and they don't put fake dye. It's that fake dye that really is so
well,
bad
that's
for you.
What,
you can get the spicy stuff with whole foods, but that fake stuff.
That's the
good.
Same even for Andy with his cooking. He cooks a lot of Filipino food and they use something called banana ketchup. And one thing that's listed there, it's red dye to make it that, because red is a color that's enticing. I don't know. But he then started making his own sauce and use beetroot powder.
Beetroot powder.
Nice.
So
paprika.
I mean, if you like that taste, if you want that color, there's other options. But
anyway, that is really funny. Okay, you guys, for real, enough about that, because it is time to shout some words and just some narratives for people with Down syndrome. Welcome, everybody, to the Lucky Few podcast. We are so excited to have Dr. Lorraine Schatz joining us today from the Massachusetts General Hospital Raising Healthy Hearts Clinic. Dr. Schatz, a pediatrician and fetal cardiologist, is here to talk about congenital heart defects and heart health for individuals with Down syndrome. We're so glad to have her on today for such an important conversation.
So stick around and welcome to the Lucky Few podcast.
When Chris and I first began meeting with Enable S&P to discuss long-term planning for ACE's future, we were deep in the process of determining if we should make a life-changing move from San Francisco to the East Coast. They helped us look at the long-term financial repercussions of the possible move, including how it would affect the savings we have for our older sons, in addition to what we hope to have in place for ACE. Their one-on-one guidance, their expert advice, especially when it comes to special needs planning, were exactly what we needed. Life is uncertain, but Enable S&P wants to help you create a plan that works for your family right now and every day in the future.
Find out more at EnableSNP.com.
Okay, everybody listening, guess what is happening on March 8th?
Something special.
In San Diego, California, there is going to be a live event. That is right. Micah, woo! Mercedes, and Heather from the Lucky Few podcast. That's us. We're going to be together in person in San Diego, California. Why, friends?
Because we are celebrating the fact that we've had 1 million downloads.
1 million downloads. We're going to get together in real life.
I need to see your face.
And it's in San Diego, and tickets are on sale right now. Okay, listeners, this is going to be worth it to come. If you can't make it, we're also doing a virtual ticket. So hop on that online. Where do you go to buy it?
Run, don't walk.
Run, don't walk. LuckyFewPodcast.com. Hit that link. Get your ticket today. Invite your girlfriend and your neighbor. Date night. However you want to do it. It's going to be amazing. Woo! We'll see you there.
All right, friends, we are here with Dr. Lorraine Schratz. Dr. Lorraine Marasco Schratz is a pediatric and fetal cardiologist at Massachusetts General for Children and an instructor at the Harvard Medical School. She attended Union College and Albany Medical College in their 6-year accelerated medical education program. Dr. Schratz trained in pediatrics and pediatric cardiology at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center and is board certified in both. As a fetal cardiologist, she makes diagnoses in the prenatal period in the outpatient setting, and she cares for patients from the newborn years to young adulthood. Dr. Schratz is also the director of Raising Healthy Hearts Program, a preventative cardiology program for children and families at risk for heart disease and the complications of overweight and obesity. To better serve these patients, she recently earned her board certification in lifestyle medicine and in obesity medicine. She serves on the board for the Massachusetts chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. As president of the Bristol North District Medical Society and in multiple roles at the Massachusetts Medical Society. She and her husband continue to parent 5 children, ages 19 to 29 years. Woo! I can't think of anyone more qualified to talk to us today. So everybody, we want to welcome to the show Dr. Lorraine Schratz. Welcome to the show, Dr. Schratz.
Welcome. I'm so happy to be here talking with you today.
Thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Well, I've listened to your podcast, and I think that, you know, you're providing a wonderful space for families who are caring for children with Down syndrome. So I'm excited to talk with you about heart disease.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the podcast, too.
That's awesome.
Let's start with how your background in cardiology and your connection to working with individuals with Down syndrome.
So I have been a pediatric cardiologist, if you count my training years, since 1992, so quite a long time. And I trained in Cincinnati at the Children's Hospital there. Because children with Down syndrome have a very high rate of having a heart defect, I've worked with lots of children and their families. Happily, sometimes I get to tell them there's no issue, and other times we end up becoming, you know, pretty close and working through the various things that come up with heart disease. And if it's okay, I'd love to tell a story about early in my fellowship because it really stands out in my mind. When I was in probably my second year or first year of fellowship, I had a patient who was 19 who had Down syndrome and had unrepaired heart disease because she was born in 1973. before surgery was done routinely. Frankly, on a lot of people, that those were the early days of congenital heart surgery, and it really wasn't being offered to people with Down syndrome. So she ended up having a lot of complications related to not having had the surgery. And I cared for her and her family for about a year or so. And then she passed. And it was one of those almost life-changing experiences to imagine that she wasn't offered surgery, that even at that point, we were regularly offering and providing to our little kiddos who had Down syndrome and other conditions. Hmm. That sounds like a bummer way to start the podcast.
Well, it's the reality of those times, right? Yeah. And like, it's just wild. I mean, 1970s isn't that long ago to think that heart surgery wasn't being offered like routinely. Like I've never even thought about that part in medical history, and then how that, you know, affects the Down syndrome community. So that was really interesting. Not a bummer way. It's a bummer that that happened, but interesting also.
But yeah, and powerful that that's what brought you into working with individuals with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a close friend who lived in my neighborhood who had Down syndrome. She was born a year or two before me. So 1977, 1978, and she needed to have heart surgery. And it was, I mean, her parents had to drive a couple of days to get to a hospital that could offer it to her. I mean, it was just a very challenging, just even then in 78, to get the kind of surgery that your baby needed.
And then, of course, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, and that opened doors for many people. And I'm happy to say that now I have lots of patients, and it's, you know, standard. Of course, they're offered the cardiac surgery and care that they need.
Well, can you talk to us just a little bit especially for our listeners whose children haven't needed to have surgery, whose children were luckily not born with congenital heart defects. Can you tell us about just why so many children with Down syndrome, I think it's around 50%, is that right, are born with congenital heart defects, and why that happens so often with Down syndrome?
So you're right. It is about half of all children who have Down syndrome will be diagnosed with a congenital heart defect. And it is genetic. It's not the only genetic condition that's associated with a higher rate of heart defects. It's just the most common one. And it is felt to be related to some change in the genetic material, but it's really not completely well known. So there's not really a definitive answer to that. We do know that congenital heart disease in general is multifactorial. So there are some genetic components, and there are things that run in families, but there's also some environmental influence. You know, for example, just the health of the pregnancy, whether the mother uses substances, things like that can change the risk for heart disease. But again, there's not a definitive thing to point to, but it clearly links to the genetic change.
Interesting.
And the other thing that I'll mention is congenital heart disease is the most common birth defect, and people actually don't think of it or know it. And care for kids with heart disease actually receives less funding than some other ailments that children have.
What's your opinion on that? Why do you think that is?
I think that's a great question. I'm not entirely sure. Either we are not asking for that research appropriately, you know, the research dollars, or other conditions just have tugged at the heartstrings of people more, that they'll donate more to that. But again, that's not just that's in general. That's not just patients with Down syndrome.
So what are the potential impacts of a congenital heart defect on the overall health of individuals with Down syndrome who have a congenital heart defect?
So a lot of that depends on what the congenital heart defect is. So when we say half of all children who have Down syndrome for a diagnosis will have a form of heart disease, that can range from the most common defect that requires surgical repair to maybe things that are more minor that don't need surgery. So in order to understand that, just kind of as a way of describing what is congenital heart disease in patients with Down syndrome and without Down syndrome, it's related to a change in the way the heart develops. The heart's usually fully developed by about the 8th week, 7 to 8 weeks of gestation, so during the mom's pregnancy, and that can kind of go off and not develop the way that it typically does. And so the most common heart issue that we will diagnose in babies with Down syndrome is called an atrioventricular septal defect or AV canal defect. And that essentially is a large hole in the center of the baby's heart so that there's an opening between the top two chambers and an opening between the bottom two chambers, and the valves are involved. So without a surgical repair for that, the impact would be tremendous and a child would not survive, or would survive and be suffering many impairments like high blood pressure in the lungs and not be able to run and play and do what we all would want our kids to do. On the other hand, a child who has a very small hole in the heart, either between the upper or the lower chambers, and that's all they have, could get by without any intervention at all. So no surgery, no procedure, and live a good life without suffering ill effects. I'm not sure if I answered the question fully, but.
No, it's great.
That's great. My son, August, is 10 now, but he had a complete AV canal repair. And he's my second kid with Down syndrome. And just like to speak to what you're talking about earlier, how far surgery has come, like how far we've come when it comes to kids with congenital heart defects and surgeries and repairs. And my oldest daughter also has a heart defect. And the surgery was so, our experience with her was so good. Like almost like a, it just felt really miraculous. And like, I don't wish people to have this. It's not something I want for my kid to have, but having gone through that with her and coming out on the other side with her being healthy and strong and her heart being healthy and strong, it was like, oh, we can totally do this. And the doctor's attitudes, even the surgeons are like, oh no, this is what we do. Like, I just remember being so, so scared, rightfully so, just like my kid, my 4-month-old baby is going in for open heart surgery, as terrifying as it sounds. And, but the doctor's like, oh no, we, like, this is what we do. We do this day in, day out. This is what we do. We know what we're doing. We've done this thousands of times. This is what we do. And so just that, like the advancements that have happened have been so significant, and it gave me so much peace going into our second surgery. It's like, oh no, this is what y'all, this is what you guys do. It feels so, for the most part, so treatable. Do you feel like that as the cardiologist too?
Absolutely. So Heather, that sounds like conversations that I've had with people where I'll be drawing pictures. I mean, we're on a podcast. I can't show you pictures, but I'll be drawing pictures and describing this hole in the center of the heart, and, or between the lower chambers or the upper chambers, depending on what that child has. And the parents typically look scared because it's kind of, nobody ever really wants to meet a cardiologist talking to them about their child. And when we are moving on in the conversation, that's exactly what I say. This is very well known. We know how to repair it. We know what to look for immediately after the surgery. We know what to look for over that child's lifetime. And so for someone who doesn't work in our field, it's certainly scary, and it really should be scary. But yet the people who do this for a job, it's kind of like bread and butter, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love hearing that. And I love this sense of like, I want that for all parents to be able to have a doctor where they're, where they feel completely like their child's taken care of. Like they don't have to understand everything because there's an expert who does understand everything. Mm-hmm. What a gift that is.
And so one of the things that I'm involved in personally is fetal echocardiography. Mm-hmm. So I meet with families who are, for one reason or another, at risk of having a child with a heart defect. And the prenatal screening that raises the suspicion of Down syndrome is one of the reasons that people will come see me. And it's really wonderful to be able to have those early conversations at a time when parents can process that information mm-hmm. and take it into account with like everything else they're being told, and not have to hear it when the baby's already born, which is, you know, mm-hmm. already going to be an emotional time just because someone just had a baby. So mm-hmm. that's a gift. If you live near a center that offers it, of course, you know, to your point, Micah, about your neighbor having to drive a few hours to get care. So there are some places in the United States and certainly in the world where they're not close to a physician who can do a fetal echo, but it's really a gift mm-hmm. when we can do that.
Hmm. Yeah. I got to experience that with my son's prenatal diagnosis. And then I went in for the fetal echo and, you know, there was, it really was a, over and over, I was grateful for my prenatal diagnosis. And that was one of the moments when I really was as overwhelming as it felt, just to feel like I could go into his birth knowing how, knowing the state of his heart. And, you know, there was no way to know for sure. And you can speak to that maybe, Dr. Schratz, but from what they told me, for the most part, they could tell that there wasn't anything going on. And after he was born, when he was 10 days old, we went back for an echo, echocardiogram. And so that was how we were able to figure out that he didn't have any mm-hmm. kind of heart condition. Is that generally how you go about it after a prenatal diagnosis?
Yeah, so that's quite typical. So if someone were to see me for a fetal echocardiogram, we're really quite good at ruling out major heart problems that would, for example, change the location that the woman had to deliver the baby so that the baby could get immediate care. There are limitations, like some very small holes are hard to rule out, just based on size and the physiology, the way the blood pressure and everything is inside the baby or inside when the baby's inside the mom. So that follow-up echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart, for those who don't know that term, that's really important after the baby is born to just confirm the diagnosis and look and make sure there's not a small hole. And obviously to confirm a diagnosis if one was made on the fetal echo. For moms who didn't get a fetal echo and there's a diagnosis of Down syndrome in their child, we typically like to see those babies within the first couple of months because, you know, sooner being better. Mm-hmm. But if the baby looks great and the pediatrician is happy, then, you know, the parents don't need to panic to get in to see the cardiologist. But usually we like to see them fairly soon because it's always better to know.
Hmm. So most of the time being involved with the Down syndrome community, especially through social media, you know, there'll be like a video that goes with the baby and it looks so serious and scary, and which it totally is. So it's been kind of comforting and interesting to hear from you, doctor, about how it is scary and honoring that, but it's also kind of routine. How can we help moms and dads with that? Like, what should doctors be doing? Because everybody also has such a different experience. Like, you sound so lovely and I would trust you and comforting. But I also hear so often in our community about that doctor-patient relationship and there being some like tension, or it could feel scary. And Have you experienced that? What can you offer, just in case we have other doctors listening, which would be so amazing, advice and thoughts on that?
You bring up a really good point that every family, every mom, every dad, and every child, and we know that the kids are going to get older, mm-hmm. right? So the doctor has to interact with them as well, is unique. Mm-hmm. And I, as a physician, when I'm counseling people, whether it's a newborn or prenatally, will describe what I see and, you know, give the facts, but then I sort of will pause and then reflect, did that make sense? You know, here's what we know. I often will talk about what I know about other families' journeys and validate what people are feeling. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. And, you know, I don't have a child with congenital heart disease and I don't have a child with Down syndrome. So I am only going by what I have my lived experience with my other families, and everyone will be different, but giving them that space is really important. And I also think knowing that they're going to come back and likely need to hear the very same explanation again. Mm-hmm. It's really tough. And in particular, if a mom for a fetal echocardiogram comes by herself, it's really hard to hear the news, react to the news, and remember it.
Yeah, totally. Definitely. I mean, right. Even like I'll hear like an answer machine message from my doctor about an appointment, and then 2 seconds later, I have to play it again. Like, you just can't hear big news one time, right? I love that you notice that in patients, and because it probably, I like want to honor doctors in that this stuff is repetitive and that it takes conscious effort to have that pause in that moment of reflection that it's repetitive for you, but kind of the first time for the parents in the room.
Mm-hmm. And also really getting to know the family and where they are. So there are some of our patients who will ask for a very high level of detail to the point where I almost feel like I need to go do a medical literature search to adequately answer their question. And then there are other parents who will kind of say, okay, that's enough. Like, I don't need any more of the science, you know, handle it, you handle it, or let them kind of take it step by step when it needs to be addressed. And that's okay. I mean, I think that's probably one of the things that's really important for your audience to hear is wherever they are, it's okay.
That's really good. And I mean, I would just speak to that from the parent side. I remember somebody saying early on, because our oldest daughter, Mason, had a congenital heart defect. She had pulmonary hypertension. She was a very sick little girl. And someone had said, take a notebook with you and write things down and ask your questions. And how helpful that was for me, because it is, the medical world is a different language if it's not something you're familiar with. And just encouraging parents listening, it's a new muscle to flex to insert, it was for me, to insert my needs into a doctor's office, because there's an intimidation there. There can be, because of how much the person knows about what's going on with my kid, that I have no clue. And sometimes can feel like, should I ask this question again, again, again? But getting to the point of like flexing that muscle of saying, can you explain this different? I'm not understanding what you're saying. Like, okay, thank you for saying that. I still don't know what you're talking about. Is there another way that you can help me understand this? And we've had incredible medical professionals working with our specialty doctors with both of my kids. But just as parents, like encouraging you that ask as much as you need to ask. Ask, like, write down what you need, ask for things printed, follow up, insert yourself into your child's medical care, because the doctors, I you can speak to this, doctor, but I think the doctors mm-hmm. are great with that, right? It's not an irritant. It's like, sometimes I think in my experience, some doctors need to be reminded that, oh yes, I actually have a lot of questions. They're like, oh yeah, of course, of course, mm. of course.
I agree. It's really important to ask the questions as many times as you need, take notes. Also, I would say, as a physician, embrace my team. So especially mm-hmm. if a baby has complex congenital heart disease and we're talking about surgery, there will be a team at that medical center, you know, probably a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, the nurses in a NICU or in the cardiac ICU. There's a bunch of people who are experts in caring for babies with these conditions, and use them. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Can you maybe walk us through? I know that all there are lots of different kinds of congenital mm-hmm. heart defects with different processes and outcomes, but can you kind of walk us through, like, a child's been diagnosed with a heart defect? Maybe you give a couple different examples, and then kind of what comes next. So typical treatment plans that might come up, and even like through surgery, what happens after surgery? Does that feel like something you can answer, or is there just too many options there?
There are a lot of options, but I think I can answer it. Okay. So in terms of the heart conditions that are most likely to be seen in a baby with Down syndrome, the first is, like I mentioned, that complete AV canal defect, the hole in the center of the heart. And then there's ventricular septal defects, or holes between the lower chambers, or atrial septal defect, a hole between the upper chamber. And I hope I'm not losing everybody. there's also another condition that's called tetralogy of Fallot. That's a hole in the heart and some blockage of blood flow to the lungs. So those are kind of the big ones. They're also kind of referring back to what Mercedes was saying before. All babies before they're born have a connection between the lung and the body artery, and it goes away after we're born. Some babies it'll take a little longer, or some kids it'll need to be treated. So those are kind of the top line. There are others, and I'm not going to, you know, open up my textbook of pediatric cardiology and read it all to you. Most of those diagnoses won't need to be intervened upon immediately. So it's, you know, the majority, it'll be take care of what the baby needs right off the bat, which would be how well, basic things. How well is the baby eating? How do we need to support the baby's nutrition to grow? And kiddos with Down syndrome often need support with their feeding. So that's something that may need to be addressed. The other thing that can happen early on in children who have Down syndrome, and Heather, you kind of mentioned this in your daughter, many will have high blood pressure in their lungs or pulmonary hypertension. And that's because their lung blood vessels often don't develop as fully as other babies. And then on top of it, some of the heart disease can lead to that over time. But in terms of the immediate, we'll kind of see what the baby needs so that they can go home with their parents, you know, and then it'll be frequent follow-up visits. Most of the heart disease that will need surgery is going to be done by 4 to 6 months of the baby's life. So it's kind of like a first year of life. This is going to be sort of intense, and you're going to know your cardiologist really well. So hopefully you are comfortable asking questions and having them help you with your baby's care. All of the usual baby things are the same things we're looking at. Is the baby breathing comfortably? Is the baby feeding okay and gaining weight and going to the bathroom?
I think it was interesting that you said blood pressure in the lungs. I didn't know that you could have high blood pressure like in a specific area. And is that just for when they're a baby, or could that again come up again later in life with a heart defect?
So pulmonary hypertension or higher blood pressure in the lungs is something that we see in newborn babies. Newborns with Down syndrome have a higher chance of having it because, as I said, they can have underdeveloped blood vessels in their lungs. And that may need some support early on, like having the baby on oxygen or even on some kind of mechanical ventilation until that sort of improves, which it tends to do. It can be a factor that can complicate the heart surgery that they're going to have in that, number one, we want to know it before we send a baby into surgery. We want to know everything we can about all the potential things that would complicate the surgery or the recovery. And so there's a couple of assessments that could be considered, including putting the baby on oxygen and doing an echocardiogram on oxygen, or even doing a cardiac catheterization before a surgery to directly measure the blood pressure in the lungs. And that just tells us, the cardiac surgeon and the cardiac intensivists who take care of the baby after the surgery, whether the baby may need medications and other support to kind of get them through that operative time. That said, they generally, although there might be those complications, the mortality rate is the same as other kids that have the same kind of heart surgery. So a little more care needed. But again, we know what to look for to know how to do it. But scary those few days for the parents. By no means would I ever, you know, kind of diminish that it's as a parent, it's scary to be in an ICU and see your child with, you know, a breathing tube and IVs and things.
And is this, you know, I think we see a lot that when babies are born with Down syndrome, they are in the NICU. Is that most often because of these two things you just described, like the congenital heart defect or the high blood pressure in the lungs? Or is it also, it could also be a combination of other things, or premature birth? Are those things usually the main reasons why babies are in the NICU?
So there are other reasons, such as low birth weight. So babies who have Down syndrome often will be born weighing less. And then if they have any kind of feeding issues on top of it, then that will take longer to kind of figure out how do we best support this baby. There are other potential medical complications if they, for example, don't pass meconium, which is those first really tarry poops that babies have, then that would need to be investigated. You know, those are the typical things.
Dr. Schatz, both my kids came home after a couple of days. They both were diagnosed in utero with congenital heart defects. Both my kids came to me through adoption, so I wasn't a part of my older daughter, but my son, I had an opportunity to be in his life while he was in utero. But both of them came home, like them having a heart defect didn't equal a NICU stay. And they just came home, and it was like they were a textbook at 4 months old. They started going into heart failure, and it was time to have surgery, and they had their surgery, and we made it through on the other side. My daughter, like I said, had pulmonary hypertension, which was primary. So stop me or correct me here, because I'm not the cardiologist, but Mercedes is asking about the pulmonary hypertension. My daughter had all those things you said, the heart cath ahead of time when she was a baby to measure. They did a PD ligation because the pressure in her lungs was so severe that they closed up that tiny hole that would eventually close on its own just to see if it relieved some of the pressure. And then a few months later, she had open heart surgery. But because her hypertension was considered primary, her surgery, closing the hole in her heart, didn't alleviate the pressure in her lungs. Whereas my understanding is oftentimes with a congenital heart defect, they'll have pulmonary hypertension, but once you close that hole, it alleviates that. I'm going to pause there and you can jump in and correct everything I just said wrong.
Heather, you are very knowledgeable, and it's obvious you paid attention to what was going on with your two children. So what you've talked about is the distinction between primary pulmonary hypertension, meaning truly from small blood vessels and a lung issue, and high blood pressure in the lungs, pulmonary hypertension related to the flow through the holes in the heart. So what happens when you have a hole in your heart, you're not going to have a separate circulation to your lungs and a separate circulation to your body. They're open to each other. And the blood pressure in our bodies, what we measure in our arm or a leg, is higher than the blood pressure in the lungs it's supposed to be. Even if you have elevated blood pressure in the lungs, generally it's not as high as the body. And so we get a shunt of blood going through the hole, and the lungs will see more blood flow as a result. That's what you were talking about, Heather, about the, you know, oh, and then right by around 4 months of age, they started showing signs of some heart failure or congestive heart failure, which really isn't that the heart's failing. It's that more blood's flowing out to the lungs. And then the baby breathes faster and can't eat well. And we treat them with medicine to get them to the surgery. If we waited too long for the surgery, or like the case of the dear young woman that I talked about at the beginning, she didn't get surgery. All that extra blood flow to the lungs over time will also damage the lungs and cause pulmonary hypertension. And at a point, it can become irreversible, which is what happened to my patient from long ago. But to be happy about it, we do know how to treat these things. I mean, these are kind of standard things that every physician who trains in pediatrics and certainly pediatric cardiology, we know to look for it. We know to treat it. And we tell our parents to look for it.
Right.
And I just love your overall tone too. I think it's important for families, and I'm assuming there's parents listening maybe who are just getting a diagnosis of a congenital heart defect, maybe in utero or at birth, and how they know heart surgery is in their future. And all of it is so, like, that feeling of terror and being overwhelmed is that's the right feeling, mom and dad. You know, like, that's pretty accurate to feel that. And to know that our babies are so incredible at their letting their bodies heal and be made whole. And you've got all the resources, you know. And my Macy is now 15, and we see cardiology once every 2 years. And he says, if I didn't know her from birth, I wouldn't even know that her heart, that she had surgery. Like, it's so, her heart is just so complete. And I just remember those early years thinking, like, is she going to make it to tomorrow? And that's so real. But I also just want to have the listeners, like, hold that little bit of hope that, or a big bit of hope that there, our kids, we are so, for most of us, not everyone in the world, which is reality, for most people in the United States, we just have access to the best of the best people knowing what they're doing. And like, there's a team of people holding you up, and like Dr. Schatz here. So Dr. Schatz, so thankful for you and your kind.
Well, that's really sweet of you to say. And I love my patients, and I love what I do. So, you know, I feel like it's my privilege to get to know families like yours, you know, your families. I think one of the things you mentioned was the ongoing follow-up. And I think I'd be remiss if I didn't say that if a baby has a diagnosis of a heart condition, and whether or not they have surgery, we will continue to follow that child. And even as an adult, they'll be followed by cardiology, usually by adults with expertise in congenital heart disease. So that should be expected. And the other thing I think is a sort of a hopeful thing. Although some of our patients who have any kind of heart disease for any reason, no matter how many chromosomes they have, sometimes they need a repeat operation and more complex surgeries. That's sort of a plan that they need multiple operations. However, our patients who have Down syndrome, research has shown that they're really not more likely to need a second operation or a third operation. unless they start out with a diagnosis where that is the plan. But really important to do the follow-up care.
That's amazing. I have a question, since we're talking about the follow-up care. I guess I was wondering, and I'm sure it's probably like a good diet and like healthy foods and exercise, but anything else to add to just like, I don't know, to keep your child with Down syndrome's heart as healthy as possible, especially if they have had heart surgery before as babies, and then like thinking about how that kind of affects, and I don't know if we dove into this too much, but how does, I guess, how does having a heart defect affect possibly overall your child with Down syndrome's body, like from birth to as they get older, can there still be effects? And is that linked? Because I think in your bio, briefly reading about it, is that linked to obesity and to other things that happen as time goes on? Or we're so knowledgeable now and like, and we have so many more opportunities, but I could see how that probably was harder in the past. But in your experience, how can we help like with those other medical things that might come in later in life when you have a child with a heart defect? Okay.
First of all, I love your question. Thank you for asking that. Because I love to talk about preventative cardiology.
That's what I was looking for. That's the beautiful word I was looking for.
Preventative.
Thank you, doctor.
You're welcome. So I guess before I jump into the preventative part, one of the things while you're going for the follow-up care with your child, always remember that you are the expert in your child. So I might be the expert in pediatric cardiology when we're all sitting in the room, but you know your child. And it's really important to communicate any change or concerns or worries. You know, again, back to the pulmonary hypertension, the way that will often show up if a child continues to have it or it develops is they'll be short of breath and less active. Mm. Well, a person with Down syndrome may not be able to express that feeling. Mm. And so we will heavily rely on the parents to tell us something has changed or I'm concerned. And, you know, again, it depends on the verbal skills of that individual patient, but, you know, that may persist for their life. So continue to be an advocate and, you know, tell your doctor when you're concerned about your child, even if they're 20, continue to do that. In terms of the prevention, we know that, individuals who have Down syndrome are at higher risk for obesity. There are other genetic changes that are also associated with a greater likelihood of obesity, so they're not alone in that. And so it's really important, as best you can, to set up those healthy habits early on in their life. And I recognize sometimes that's easier said than done because some children have sensory issues and they don't want to eat. Mm-hmm. And they have a very restrictive diet or they won't eat things that are red or that have, you know, fruit that's kind of has some texture to it. So it can be really tough. Leverage the resources like feeding teams, you know, speech language pathologists, OTs who might work with you on that. But as much as you can, the more you set those healthy habits from the earliest point in the child's life, the easier it's going to be to have them have healthy habits, which essentially means eat food that looks like food, lots of fruits and vegetables, and not a whole lot of ultra processed foods. So that's one thing. And help them move, you know, have them get up and move in whatever way makes all of you happy, whether it's a playground or playing with a dog or dancing, whatever. Because those are the two most important things. We do know that adults who have Down syndrome have increased cardiovascular risk. What we have found is that in the absence of obesity, their cholesterol panel's not actually higher than the rest of the population, barring a familial hyperlipidemia like high cholesterol, separate genetic issue, which we would prefer people don't and get that one as well. But, you know, again, the weight really makes a difference. And then the other thing is, you know, back to the whole issue of advocacy, there are disparities in cardiovascular care of people with Down syndrome compared to the general population. And so they will present later to care. There are guidelines. There's, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics has a whole health supervision for children and adolescents with Down syndrome that lists year by year. Make sure your child's doctor is aware of it. And then when they get to be adults, they still need ongoing monitoring and care. So advocacy is important, and find a doctor who enjoys working with your family member.
That's great. Super helpful. Before we wrap up this conversation, are there any other resources or organizations that families of individuals with Down syndrome and congenital heart defects can access through support for support? Any ones that you recommend?
Yes. And one thing, I just wanted to share something before I give you those resources. I saw in my office last week on the same day, two families with two of my patients, lovely, both of them little girls with Down syndrome. One is a teenager and one is a newborn baby. And I asked them, okay, I'm going to go on this podcast. What do you want me to make sure other families heard or know? And the message was, basically, it's going to be okay. It will be scary. It's going to be okay. And find, you know, your tribe, your support network, which kind of leads into the question. And again, thank you for holding the space as a support network for other families who are raising children and have other adult loved ones who have Down syndrome. I think it's really important work. So in terms of resources, I have a feeling that a lot of your audience know about these. The National Down Syndrome Society actually has a little handout about the heart and Down syndrome that is worthwhile, as well as, you know, other resources on their page. If it comes to specific heart conditions, the American Heart Association is a big favorite of mine, because if you go under health conditions tab, you can pick those out. And Mercedes, to your question about, well, what should we do? They also have resources, including recipes and, you know, healthy eating. So that's worth checking out. There's the, I'm in Massachusetts. So the Massachusetts Down Syndrome Congress has a lot of important information. And I think it's the Global Down Syndrome Foundation that has links by state. So that if you are in another state, you can click that link and see what resources are there. Parent support groups, I think, are really useful. Always remember, though, that your own child is very unique. And so your life experience and theirs won't be identical to other people. But, you know, you can always reapply with shared knowledge.
I love that.
Oh, I had one other. I found a foundation because I was coming on this podcast. There's a Brett Boyer Foundation, which a family actually created to honor their baby. And they had a bunch of information there as well.
Okay. That's awesome.
Great. We'll make sure we put links in our show notes to all of those organizations you brought up. And we're so thankful that you could be here with us, Dr. Schratz. Thank you for taking the time.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
We are going to take a break and be right back.
Listen, it's hard to be a grown-up, balancing careers, finances, and caregiving for our kids and our elders. These are the great stressors of modern life. But what those of us raising a child with a disability don't always feel free to talk about is the unique financial stress of planning for a child's future when we know they will need financial support throughout their life. How do you think about saving for your child with a disability? How do you make sure your children without disabilities get what they need as well? How do you think about retirement, caring for your parents, the kids' college, and your personal family dreams? Enable S&P isn't just a financial planning organization.
and they aren't just advisors there to help with the specifics of your child who lives with disability. They walk you through the financial planning needs of the whole family. When we decided to move from San Francisco to New Jersey, Enable S&P helped us look at that move in light of our financial dreams, our hopes for ACE, and the needs of our older sons. Their one-on-one guidance, their expert advice, especially when it comes to special needs planning, were exactly what we needed. Life is uncertain, but Enable S&P wants to help you create a plan that works for your family right now and every day in the future.
Find out more at enablesnp.com.
All right, friends, it is time to wrap up this episode. You can head over to luckyfew.co, use code podcast to get 10% off all your narrative shifting gear. And we also send out a weekly newsletter. Sign up for that newsletter over at heatheravis.com.
Thanks, Josh Avis, for editing this episode, and Ashley Fracolassi for producing it. If you like this episode, share it with family and friends, and don't forget to subscribe.
And check us out at theluckyfewpodcast.com for the show notes and all the things we talked about today, which is going to be rich and hearty. So make sure to check that out. Oh, and be sure to follow on social media at The Lucky Few Pod.
And sweet listener, today you're slaying it. We love you so much. Always cheering you on. We can't wait to be together for another episode next week. Until then, stay heart healthy.
Ooh, oh, bye.
Hey. Heart healthies. Bye.
Bye.